Great. So how was that for an auto parts manufacturer's video?
Pretty good tune, eh?
What's that?
Pretty good tune.
Yeah, yeah, I thought it was.
That's downhill from there.
The video reflects the man, so which we're now going to find out. All right, well, it's a real great privilege to have Rob up here and to present the award to him in a few minutes. You know, you've got this amazing story, and I want to just ask a few questions around it. So you started off in law, and you went from being a lawyer to an entrepreneur. So just describe how and why that happened.
Maybe I wasn't a very good lawyer. actually, we were pretty entrepreneurial as lawyers. We always thought that the provision of legal services was a client-driven business. We didn't view it as, you know, a profession where we were owed work by our clients. And so we were pretty entrepreneurial. I started a big firm, and then I and some very entrepreneurial friends started a firm that did corporate securities and tax in the 90s. We worked for a lot of entrepreneurs. We're pretty entrepreneurial ourselves. We worked for RIM and OpenText, took companies like that public, which was really cool. And so we did a lot of entrepreneurial stuff. And in the context of that, the partners all got involved in business. And, were officers of business, maybe chairs. We had a couple of guys that did secondments as presidents and CEOs. And then late 90s, I got recruited by Frank Stronach, who was a fairly well-known entrepreneur, the founder of Magna, to go there and be EVP and special counsel to the chairman, which I did a little bit. I really liked the auto parts business. I didn't like the horse racing business as much. And then basically, you know, Frank and I left because I quite frankly felt that we had some differences of views. But then I was chair of a little metal fabricating company that did nothing with auto, but got together with two very senior Magna guys, the top two guys in the metal forming division, and we decided to build a business that was a competitor to Magna. We thought that there was tremendous opportunity in the marketplace.
Sorry, so just to interject there, so did you stop practicing at the law firm and then said, okay, I'm going to stop that, I'm now going to start a business with these two guys, set a new company, stop that,
well,
stop the law,
or how
did that happen?
It was kind of a seamless web. You know, I always say that when I was in law, everybody asked me about business, and when I was in business, everybody asked me about law. So, you know, the key is to know a little more than the other guy about the subject he's asking you about. But it was kind of a seamless web. I think that, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, and, you know, some of the speakers who are fantastic this afternoon have done a lot of different things. It's kind of a mindset. And, you know, I never started out and said, you know, in my future I'm going to be a manufacturer or someone involved in auto parts. Those of you that know my skill set at changing oil in cars and stuff would certainly relate to that. But, you know, I've always thought it was, you know, terrific in the workplace to be able to build things. And, you know, I remember when we started the law firm, people said, you know, why are you doing that? You left a big law firm and you know, you kind of, you know, had the gold at the end of the rainbow and everything. I said, well, I want to work with my friends and I want to help people build things and I want to make a difference and I want to effectively, you know, be relevant in what I do. You can make a lot of money doing a lot of things that you don't like to do. I wanted to, effectively work and have a passion for my work.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the classic challenges for an entrepreneur, looking at the opportunity cost. So for a lot of people who consider entrepreneurship, what are they presently doing and how much better might an entrepreneurial outcome be? And so for a lot of individuals, of course, they don't want to take that risk. Right? They don't want to give up a lucrative legal career, accounting career, going to a different field. So you took that risk. And when did you start to realize we're getting some good traction here and this thing is really going to be successful?
Well, it probably wasn't, you know, some people say right at the outset. Our first day as an auto parts company was September 10, 2001. And we bought three presses. And then we were looking for financing. And the next day, of course, was 9/11. And I kind of looked at it and said, well, this is not going to be a long-term business. So, you know, we'll see what happens. So that I wouldn't say that was my most optimistic day. But quite frankly, we thought that there was a tremendous opportunity in the auto parts industry because we thought that it was going to die. It was going to crash and burn because of, you know, some of the inflationary bubbles that Peter Hall talked about. And we thought we had good people. We had access to capital. We were really smart. and aggressive and entrepreneurial. And we thought that, you know, out of the ruins comes opportunities. And we said, you know, we're going to build a company that competes with Magna, which is where a number of our people came from. We hired a number of people there, and did buy distressed assets, which we ultimately had to turn around and change their cultures, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a minute. But today, where we stand, you know, it's a good story for Canada and Ontario. You've heard about the new NAFTA, the U.S. MCA, and so forth. But the largest metal former in the auto industry in North America is Magna. We're the second largest. And so, you know, the top two are in Canada, and, you know, I think we've achieved our goal on that. We compete in some areas. We don't compete in some others. But, you know, two Canadian companies going toe-to-toe all over the world is pretty cool.
So what's the unique value proposition of the company? Like, why do people choose Martin Rea?
It's in terms of customers, you know, the key is you've got to make great parts. You've got to have great quality, deliver on time. You know, you have to be the type of supplier that doesn't create issues. Our CEO calls it the Casper the Ghost Syndrome. You show up when you're needed, and other times you're quite silent. In terms of the proposition, in terms of employees and so forth, you know, we're trying to create a unique culture at Martin Rea that attracts people. And then when you have talent doing the right things in the right industry, you're going to grow your business over time. Mm-hmm.
So one thing you focused a lot on is corporate culture. So, Mark, can you put up the PowerPoint slides? I'll just get the clicker here. So I think that should work for the two slides.
Okay. If there's a pause, we can always put the video up again.
So, Mark, will that slide come up?
One second. Yeah.
Well, that's a good slide. Rob Wildeboer, Executive Chairman.
So I think you might have to just...
Oh, yeah, this one. Oh, I got to turn it on. See, this is why I'm not a technical guy.
Here, let's see.
Should have brought my secretary.
Okay. The light's not... Okay. Do you want to put the first slide on, Mark? Can you do that?
Well, as they're doing that, let me talk about culture. The nature of our growth, we grew by building plants from scratch and also buying distressed assets. When you buy distressed assets, they're distressed for a reason. They're in financial trouble. Probably they've got too much debt. They're probably doing the wrong processes and so forth. And when you get in there, you've got to do a lot of fixing. And one of the things that is wrong in those companies is typically their culture. It's not a future-oriented culture. It's a real problem. And so what we've spent a lot of time, and let's go to the principal slide. We spent a lot of time basically taking seven companies that we bought, six out of bankruptcy. One would have been bankrupt if it had not been owned by Thyssen Krupp, which was a big steel company. And as well as the companies that we built from scratch. And we have 44 plants in 8 countries on 4 continents, speaking different languages, different personal cultures as well. And said, what we want to do is have a standard set of views or principles that we want to run our business so that we can basically run everything in our business through those principles. And so the first thing we've done, and we've done it over a number of times and a number of iterations, is update our vision. And earlier this year, we had the leadership conference, which started that video. We brought 130 leaders of the company, and we said, you know, we're going to update our vision. Our vision in the past was, you know, to be the best automotive supplier and so forth, which is typical of vision statements. And we said, you know, we don't think that works well enough. And what we want to do is get to the why of why people come to work. And we changed our vision of making lives better by being the best supplier we can be, as opposed to benchmarking with other people. We benchmark ourselves, continuous improvement, which was talked about earlier today, in the products we make and the services we provide. We're not going to limit it by industry. And that's been extremely positive for how we've approached our business. The fact is that a lot of people come to work, and there has to be a meaning. And in essence, you're not just making products. And the nature of companies these days, you know, we have a lot of isolation in the world. The fact is that when people come to work, they view work as a place that they should have a circle of safety. It's a place that they should be treated with dignity and respect. It's often you know, the most important place for a lot of people to actually meet people and get to understand a lot of things. So we wanted our vision to respect that. And then our mission is basically take care of our people, take care of our customers, take care of our stakeholders, our owners, and our lenders, and also be very good corporate citizens. And so we've got a situation where a lot of our plants in the areas in which they operate, we encourage them to be very good in the community, to give back, to provide ways for people to volunteer. In Mexico, for example, just about every plant's involved with an orphanage. There are a lot of orphanages in Mexico, unfortunately. And then the principles that we put in place that we've spent a lot of time on and basically put into place in 2012, you know, we rolled them out and then we said, okay, we're going to start operating this way. And of course, it's been a lumpy road over time. But we said, basically, we're going to make great products. Every location is going to be a center of excellence. Discipline is key. These all flow, right? And a lot of these you see, but the ninth one that we've really spent a lot of time talking about over the last 5 years, the Golden Rule. And I'm very open about it where I say, and I've said it at shareholders' meetings, public shareholders' meetings, that it's a Christian principle. Treat people the way you want to be treated. And there are similar principles and different philosophies and religions and so forth. But I can't think of a better rule for business. Quite frankly, if you treat your customer the way you want to be treated, that's, you know, that's very important. If you treat your employee with dignity and respect when they come in, treat them the way you would treat someone that you really care about, and it's because you really care about them. And so that is something that we've really, really emphasized. And then what we drive through the leadership is it starts with the leadership. So you have to drive it every day. And we figure of 15,000 employees, we have about 7,500 that are in leadership positions. Some are supervisors, some are heads of health and safety committees, some are HR people, some are general managers. But it goes right up to the CEO and myself as executive chair. And then the next slide. And so we try and, you know, come up with a picture that kind of shows it all. And this is in plants. And by the way, our old vision, mission, and principles, we did an employee survey, 13,000 respondents, over 11,000 said they know the vision, mission, and principles. I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. That doesn't happen in public companies. That doesn't happen in factories. Maybe they're all lying, but I don't think so, because the questions were asked so that they actually had to, you know, understand some of that stuff. So this is effectively a pictorial of what we try and do. You have the Making Lives Better in the One Martin Rand. We're all working together at the top. You've got the mission statements at the sides. Take care of our people, our customers, investors, and communities. And we essentially have three foundational principles of how we operate as a manufacturing company. First, we're very lean. And lean manufacturing basically means you take waste out. We're in a business where we can't just charge whatever we want. We get the revenues that we get, and effectively, the way you get margin is you reduce cost. And you do that by taking waste out, and that's very important. It's a very important way to run your business. It's also very good for your employees because that's your source of job security. If you're competitiveness, that's job security and opportunity to grow. We're also very entrepreneurial, and entrepreneurial doesn't mean roll the dice or just take risks. Quite frankly, an entrepreneur understands that the biggest risk is standing still. That's especially true in a competitive industry. We're competing with companies all over the world. We're competing with countries all over the world. And we owe it to our people to be as competitive as possible. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, we are very entrepreneurial and continue to be so. And right at the core of it is our golden rule, treating people with dignity and respect. And what we've said is this is going to be the foundation upon which we grow. And, you know, it's really taken hold. And you know, yesterday we brought a number of investors through one of our plants here in Toronto, and we showed them what we did with our summer student program. We brought in 24 kids effectively over the summer, and, you know, by treating them in a particular way, they basically created a driverless robot in 8 weeks. And to watch the video is to, you know, how we let them do that, how we treated them right in order to do that and so forth. Like, it puts a lump in your chest. It's really cool. So that's effectively the culture we're driving. I think it is, you know, very consistent with the Golden Rule principles, very consistent with bringing Christ into the workplace in terms of how you treat people. We're not missionaries. We're a public company that, you know, is trying to be productive. But, you know, to a certain extent, I believe that this is a real source of competitive advantage. It's a very good platform in order to show your faith and to allow people to engage in those types of discussions. And that's the meaning behind the pictures. Mm.
So last question, just focused on difference making. So how would you describe your approach to making a difference? Because you're involved in a think tank, you're involved in church and school. So what gives you the impetus to take the initiative, get involved in these various different spheres?
There's nothing, you know, really, you know, I'm humbled by you know, the people this afternoon and how you know, they could describe their journey. I just think it's a question of service. You know, I believe that we're here to glorify God in all that we do. I believe that we're here to show love to our neighbor. I think the way you do that is you use the talents that God's given you and you serve them. And, you know, I wake every day and I, depending on what it is, sometimes I serve pretty good. Sometimes I serve not too good. I've made a lot of mistakes over my life. And, you know, the reality is that gives you a certain amount of wisdom. But if you have that attitude and you know, you use your skills in a particular way, what I find is you get tremendous response from people. And you know, I've been very blessed by being surrounded by people that that have helped me. I've had a lot of good mentors, and I've always surrounded myself with really good people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the thing I like about Rob's approach is he does everything in a almost like a matter-of-fact manner, that this is just what I do, and I'm trying to make a difference. There's no fanfare involved in it, just going about getting involved in things, having an impact. In terms of the Entrepreneurial Leaders Award, now some of you may recall if you were here last year and the year before, we generally give the award out on an annual basis. We've had a number of distinguished recipients. Mark, if we can just run the video on the award, and then I'll talk a bit more about it.